Psycho Man.
Hello, boys and girls, and welcome to episode 424 of the Motorcycle Men podcast. And what I have for you today is a segment from the book, The Road Most Traveled. Yes, this is a piece of the audiobook, and you're going to hear chapter 18 today. But before we get into that, just a couple little things, some news. Motorcycle Men mom is still hospitalized, and we're still working on that. Brother Tim and I are making trips from North Carolina to New Jersey. And in fact, the next episode we have is going to be our 10th anniversary show. And that's going to happen live. All four of us are going to be in one place. So stay tuned for that. That's coming up. Before we go on any further, the Motorcycle Man podcast is brought to you by Scorpion Helmets. They're offering high quality, innovative motorcycle helmets and technical apparel at an incredible value. So to learn more, get on over to ScorpionUSA.com. And Wild Ass Seats. Now, you can improve your comfort and ability to stay in the saddle longer with a cushion from Wild Ass Seats. So if you're tired of those painful pressure points and fatigue, get on over to wild-ass.com and get your cushion today. And as always, Tobacco Motor Wear. For the best in casual riding gear for men and women, there's only one place you should be going, and that is Tobacco Motor Wear. Visit them at tobaccomotorwear.com, and our listeners will get 10% off your order when you use the code MOTOMEN. Now, everyone here at the podcast is wearing Tobacco riding jeans and a California riding shirt. We love this stuff, and we can't tell you how wonderful these products are. So I wear them for every ride, and I won't ride without them. Now, you can go onto the Motorcycle Men website. That's motomenpc.com, and there are direct links to Tobacco Motor Wear there, where you can buy your stuff through the partner program that we've joined up with Tobacco Motor Wear. So do that, and there'll be listings on the website coming up right now. I believe we have the California riding shirt up there, so check that out. We're going to get the jeans up there, a whole bunch of other stuff, and of course, you will get your 10% discount. Your safety is worth it, boys and girls, so get on over to Tobacco Motor Wear and get in Dave's pants. All right, enjoy Chapter 18 from The Road Most Traveled, a motorcycle ride along the East Coast of America. Chapter 18, Stale Cuban Bread. Howling at the moon, paying a visit to Hog's Breath Saloon, following the chickens, drinking whiskey, beer, and rum punch, just to get up the next day and do it again. Danny Hoy from the song Drunk on Mallory Square. Back on the bike and on US 1, I wished it were daytime. This section of US 1 is called the South Dixie Highway. Traffic was thin, very thin, as I approached Card Sound Road on the left. This small two-lane road cuts a very straight path through the very eastern side of the Everglades in an area called the Southern Glades Wildlife and Environmental Area. From its intersection with US 1 to its termination at the Crocodile Lake National Wildlife Refuge, nearly 17 miles to the east, the road is bordered on both sides by small pines, mangrove, and various types of tropical greenery that blocks views and offers but a glimpse through to the marshlands of the Glades. Aside from an occasional canal from time to time and a steady row of concrete utility towers, there is nothing to see. With a speed limit that varies from 35 miles per hour to 55 miles per hour, Card Sound Road has the makings of an "are we there yet" kind of road. That is until you reach the 11.5 mile mark, when Alabama Jack's Bar and Grill appears seemingly out of nowhere. When you first pull up to Alabama Jack's, you might get the Porky's impression, a reference to the 1981 teen comedy film based on a fictional strip club in some Florida swamp. But when you walk in, that vibe switches over to a Jimmy Buffett's backyard. The place is so laid back, leaving to go anywhere else becomes a second thought within minutes, just like the rest of the Florida Keys vibe. Basically, Alabama Jacks is your introduction to the Keys in every sense. Built in 1950 by Jack Stratham, who may or may not have been from Alabama, and although the place has been sold several times, all subsequent owners felt it best to just leave it the way it is. So much so that, at the time of this writing, the same band has been playing there for 28 years. Lending credence to the phrase, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. The landmark eatery and bar offer waterfront dining, a live band starting at 2 p.m., great food, and the opportunity to drop your sunglasses or smartphone into the canal from the bar height tables that line the edge of the deck. I never have, thankfully, but I have been witness to several French fries that made the plunge, and other intentionally sacrificed to the waiting aquatic life below, or a brazen pelican floating nearby. With practically every surface covered in dollar bills signed in some way from visiting tourists, and stickers from everywhere, Alabama Jack's is a regular stop for my wife and I when visiting the Florida Keys. On one of the columns is a dollar bill I put there some years ago with a few of those balloon cartoon type captions over George Washington's head for effect. Additionally, somewhere in the place is a Motorcycle Men podcast sticker, but I couldn't find it either now if you put a gun to my head. From time to time, boaters tie up at the restaurant, locals and vacationers from Key Largo, just a few miles away, make the trip to Ajax for a bite to eat or some alcoholic drinks and music. Just make sure you make it to Ajax before the close at 5:30 p.m. in the off-season if you want to enjoy some of that Welcome to the Keys vibe. In season, basically the winter months, you are welcome to enjoy that vibe until 7 p.m. Next to Jax, a few years ago, there was a small drawbridge that allowed tall boats to access Little Card Sound to the north from Barn Sound to the south, and there was a small cash-only toll booth that took $1 for the crossing. It was a cute little bridge and only added to the quaintness of Alabama Jack's and the off-the-beaten-path feel of the road. Since the completion of this trip, that little bridge has been replaced by a new, taller bridge that allows for tall boats to pass beneath without the need to open the bridge and halt traffic. As one could imagine, replacing the bridge just wasn't enough, and there is a new toll in place, one that is managed by the Florida DOT, and if you have a Sun Pass, it'll cost you $1.74 to cross the bridge, $2.62 with toll by plate. Even here, in the relaxed demeanor of the Keys, the grubby paws of politics managed to creep its way into your wallet. Since it was dark, and later than I would have liked, I would skip Alabama Jack's this time and just get to the resort. This particular section of US 1 called the South Dixie Highway, often called Alligator Alley, though I've never actually seen an alligator near the roadway, I have seen a warning sign that depicted an alligator on it, is, like Card Sound Road, nothing to write home or be excited about, and with its speed limits varying from 45 miles per hour to 55 miles per hour, is nothing short of annoying. Heaven forbid you get caught behind someone who chooses to ride slower than the posted speed limit. While you may be tempted to pass such a nincompoop in the very wide left side shoulder, I would recommend not doing so because somewhere in the darkness lurks a state trooper just waiting for an impatient dumbass like you to pull a stunt like that. While the surface of the roadway is fair-ish and wide enough to accommodate two lanes in each direction, someone who makes more money than I had decided that for nearly the entire length, it would be a single lane road in each direction, only branching out to two lanes to allow for passing in a couple locations. After crossing over Lake Surprise via the Lake Surprise Viaduct, you enter Key Largo proper. One could say that this is where the Keys and the Overseas Highway officially begin, or end, depending upon which way you look at it. There is something of a debate as to where the Overseas Highway officially ends. While mile marker 106 is where the South Dixie Highway ends on maps, the unofficial end of the Overseas Highway is 7 miles back at the entrance to Card Sound Road. For the rest of us who have been to the Keys, we're satisfied with the beginning of the Overseas Highway at mile marker 106. The ride across the 7-mile stretch of nothing was uneventful and not as laborious as I expected it to be, but I was sufficiently pleased to be in the Keys. It should be noted here that it is at this point that the Keys takes on a west-southwesterly direction, and the closer you get to Key West, the further out in the Gulf of Mexico you are. Consider that while you are driving towards Key West or standing on water's edge looking out into the vast sea before you, off in the distance is not the Great Atlantic, but Cuba and the northern reaches of the Caribbean Sea. There was little activity this time of night, and what little traffic there was moved along, and there were no asshat maneuvers to be watchful of, unless I committed them myself, and I was quite sure that wouldn't happen. There are a few things one needs to know about driving in the Keys along the Overseas Highway. First, the speed limit is going to vary between 35 miles per hour and 55 miles per hour. Whatever that number is, stick to it. Local officials are intolerant of speeding, and as a deterrent, one can see patrol cars parked in center medians, on the side of the road, and behind trees and bushes, waiting for you to get impatient with these slower speeds. However, while this tactic might work most of the time, local officials might want to pay attention to the grass-cutting schedule of the local road departments and move the vehicles from time to time. Grass-cutting crews will cut around the vehicle, but neglect to use a weed whacker to finish the job. What is left is a tall swath of uncut grass around the perimeter of the vehicle, leaving passing motorists with a sense of relief knowing that they're being watched by an unmanned squad car and no fear of being ticketed. Second, the location of everything is based on what mile marker it is at. Although there are extremely few actual mile markers, like the small green signs on short posts along most highways in America that denote what mile you are at on that stretch of road, they are all but absent here in the Keys. In the absence of those markers, one only needs to look at the address number of a business, hotel, restaurant, or home to know what mile marker you are at. The first two or three numbers of any address is the mile marker number. So if the address number is 75463, you are between mile marker 75 and 76. A concept that took me a few trips to get used to. Finally, and most importantly, leave whatever degree of hurry up and impatience you have at that last gas station before Cardsound Road. There is no hurry up in the Keys. By nature, I'm a pretty laid-back person. I'm super patient. I pretty much have that whatever borderline cavalier attitude about most things. So, on my first visit to the Keys, I felt as though I was surrounded by my people. The Keys have that Caribbean vibe that just doesn't quit. Though I have been told by a few locals that it was even more so back in the 80s and earlier. In some out-of-the-way places, you can still get the sense of what they are talking about. In 1982, the United States Border Patrol set up a roadblock and inspection point at the last intersection of Cardsound Road and US 1 in front of the Last Chance Saloon. Vehicles leaving and entering the Keys were searched for narcotics and illegal immigrants, causing mile after mile of backup. The Key West City Council complained repeatedly about the roadblock and the inconvenience to travelers, claiming that it was hurting their important tourism industry. When these complaints to the U.S. federal government went unanswered and ignored, an injunction was filed against the roadblock, which also failed. As a result of these pleas to have the roadblocks removed, the then mayor of Key West, Mayor Dennis Wardlaw, and the city council declared independence from the United States on April 23, 1982. The mayor and the council felt that since the federal government had set up a border crossing as if they were a foreign nation, they figured they might as well become one. Since those who live in the Keys are often referred to as conches, the council decided to call their new micronation the Conch Republic. Upon the new declaration of secession, Mayor Wardlaw was made prime minister, which he immediately declared war on the United States and in a symbolic gesture broke a loaf of stale Cuban bread over the head of a man dressed in a naval uniform. After a one-minute pause, Wardlaw surrendered to the man in uniform and applied for $1 billion in foreign aid. The phony secession and the events surrounding it generated great publicity for the Keys, and the roadblocks and inspection station were removed. Unfortunately, it doesn't end there. In September of 1995, the federal government apparently forgot about the tenacity of the Conch people, and using the 478th Civil Affairs Battalion of the U.S. Army Reserve, conducted a training exercise simulating the invasion of a foreign nation. The simulated foreign nation? Key West. While the training exercise had good intentions, its only flaw was that the officials of the U.S. Army Reserve failed to notify the Key West Conch Republic Council of the event. Wardlaw used this as an opportunity for more publicity and mobilized the island for a full-scale war and ordered the schooner Western Union to attack an incoming Coast Guard cutter. While this may seem a serious offense and likely a bloodbath, the schooner made every effort to impress and attacked the Coast Guard ship with water balloons, conch fritters, and stale Cuban bread. The Coast Guard responded with fire hoses and quickly put an end to the battle, and the next day, the 478th issued an apology for conducting the exercise without notifying city officials, followed by a submission to surrender on September 22nd. These events continued to provide the Keys with ample tourism, with the annual reenactment of the war with the 478th, with the Coast Guard participating by spraying local boaters with fire hoses and locals responding with the same weaponry as their 1995 counterparts. Though the Conch Republic is something of a fictitious micronation, it does, with a tongue-in-cheek manner, maintain an Air Force, Army, and Navy. The Conch Republic Navy comprises of at least 10 civilian boats and the schooner Wolf. The Army consists of the 1st Conch Artillery, stationed in Fort Taylor. The Air Force has more than a dozen aircraft in its small squadron, including a 1941 Waco biplane and a 2000s-era Pitts Special biplane. The Conch Republic offers every opportunity to support the tiny nation on their website, conchrepublic.com, where you can buy Conch Republic flags, clothing, and a passport. Yes, an official-looking passport. When ordering one, you will have to provide a photo and all the necessary information, which will then appear inside the passport, pre-stamped from other questionable places. Though it is not an official passport, some have believed it to be, so much so that the FBI believes that one of the hijackers on September 11th may have purchased a Conch Republic passport. In a message on their website from the exalted Secretary of State of the Conch Republic, Captain James R. Gillaran, he welcome all comers who understand the value of humor, community, and a passion to encourage others to behave in a proud and foolish manner. Like that statement, most everything about the Keys says, and to quote the 1988 hit by Bobby McFerrin, don't worry, be happy. To maintain that attitude while not in the Keys, I have a Conch Republic flag on a flagpole in my front yard, beneath the American flag. As you can imagine, the temperatures were significantly warmer than they were when I left South Carolina earlier this morning. My visor was open, my jacket was zipped halfway up, the cuffs on my jacket were unbuttoned and flapping in the wind. The speed limit was 45 miles per hour, the traffic was virtually non-existent, and the sea air was a pleasant invasion into my helmet. I smiled to myself. I was in the Keys. I was on vacation. And the stressful thoughts and badness of the interstates, work, bills, and responsibilities were behind me for the next week. This sudden wave of relaxation came over me and I put my right foot up on the highway peg, slouched forward, and put my left hand comfortably on my left thigh, elbow out. I began singing Jimmy Buffett's 1977 hit Margaritaville out loud, and the bike's low rumble added a nice accompaniment that I sang in key with. The overseas highway alternates between a two-lane road and a four-lane, largely depending upon the surrounding area, which varies between commercial and residential slash resort slash hotel areas, and how much room the original planners had. This portion here in Key Largo was four-lane with a wide median and lined on either side by natural greenery, some strategically placed palms, and concrete utility piers and poles. A wide shoulder and a swath of grass separated the traffic from a sidewalk-slash-bike path that followed the road in lazy curves, interrupted only by driveways, side streets, and occasional businesses. Called the Overseas Heritage Trail, with over 90 miles of paved surface, 20 of those miles are in Key Largo alone. Intermittently, the path would merge with the road shoulder in high commercial business areas, and bridges would span a channel, cut, or open water, enabling the avid cyclists to ride from Key Largo all the way to Key West safely. It's on my bucket list. As I passed mile marker 103, red flashing marker lights 100 feet or so in the sky told me I was near a familiar Florida Keys landmark. The concrete monolithic tower, now owned by AT&T, and used as a cellular transmission tower, was at one time a long-range microwave transmission tower, now ominously standing since its construction in 1951 as a relic of days gone by. Originally constructed as part of a nationwide network of microwave relay towers that could send multiple telephone and television signals great distances, its days were numbered with the introduction of fiber networks and the breakup of Bell Telephone in 1982. While some towers have been converted for cellular use, many of the long-forgotten concrete monsters are abandoned and neglected. Theories surrounding this tower include its use as a communication device to Cuba, a tower to watch the bay, a hurricane early warning tower, a building elevator shaft never finished, and a training tower for firefighters. I'm sure if you were to dig deep enough, some references to UFOs and aliens could be found as well. Commercialism, as one can expect, has a foothold in the Keys, but thankfully the large chain eateries, hotels, and other corporate entities are vastly outnumbered by homegrown and local businesses. While the occasional Wendy's, McDonald's, and Burger King are scattered throughout the chain of islands, you are more likely to see places with names like Shrimp Shack, Hobo's Cafe, Dragon's Breath, Sal's Ballyhoos, and Middle Finger. Despite the infiltration of the chain businesses, it was late and the vast majority of all businesses were closed, and traffic was reduced down to a few who, like me, were on a mission and didn't have time to dawdle and sightsee whatever could be seen at 9 p.m. in the evening. Leaving Key Largo and entering Tavernier, the overseas highway reduced to a two-lane road, and the true nature of the Keys comes into play as the sight of marinas and anything having to do with fishing comes into view. Riding with my visor wide open, the smell of the sea air takes over my senses, and a gentle sea breeze sends gentle puffs of sea air into my cheeks and nose. Having replaced my dark sunglasses with clear eye protection some time ago, the salty air began to make my eyes water, and I had to squint and blink my eyes several times fast to reduce the watering and burning sensation. Eventually, I gave in to the discomfort and felt it prudent to pull over into the driveway of a closed business to wipe my eyes with a bandana I kept in my back pocket of my jeans. I returned those clear riding glasses to the windshield bag where it would remain crammed inside with a bottle of Tylenol, reading glasses, the registration and insurance cards, and a tire pressure gauge. I decided I would ride with my helmet visor partially open enough to let air in, but not enough to let debris smack me in the face. In the event my eyes tear up again, I wouldn't have to fuss with removing glasses before wiping my eyes. Entering Plantation Key, the bike rumbled passively as I rode past a few small resorts and hotels. Because I knew where I was in the island chain, I could feel the landmass getting smaller, and what little vegetation I could see would give way to open areas where the Gulf and the Caribbean could be seen. As I crossed the small Snake Creek drawbridge into Windley Key, I took a lengthy glass to my right in hopes I would see the water. All I could see was blackness and the lights of the Isla Morada Yacht Club and waterfront homes reflecting off the water. To my left was the great expanse of the Caribbean Sea, and 157 miles away was the island of Cuba. With the blackness mildly punctuated by the red and green marker lights of a few small boats returning from or beginning some night fishing, I refocused my vision on the road ahead. Just beyond the bridge were two popular dinner stops for those who crave boating combined with decent food, entertainment, and alcoholic drinks. The Island Grill and Hog Heaven Sports Bar and Grill, voted the best late night spot in Isla Morada, are two waterfront restaurants that offer all the above, including a full parking lot during the daylight hours. And on this Saturday night, there was plenty of activity to warrant a watchful eye for those just beginning their evening festivities. Though I was cruising along at 45 miles per hour, I could hear a band playing through my partially open visor as I sped up and moved over to the right, nearly onto the shoulder. I cautiously maneuvered to get around the lollygagging drivers, more interested in the evening's awaiting cocktail than what they were currently doing. The short ride along Windley Key was quiet and comfortable, and before long, I would cross another bridge into Isla Morada, but not before passing Theater of the Seas, which is basically a scaled-down version of SeaWorld without the rides and as many attractions. The Welcome to the Park was illuminated tastefully with fountains and waterfalls, gracing both the entrance and exits of the park. Having been beyond its entrance, I smiled inside my helmet and nodded my head, happy with yet another reminder that I was in the Keys. Theater of the Seas was established in 1946 by the P.F. McKenney family and is one of the oldest marine mammal facilities in the world. The McKenney family still owns and operates the park. Originally a rock quarry excavated for Henry Flagler's railroad in the early 1900s, the lagoons and lush tropical gardens at the facility are home to dolphins, sea lions, sea turtles, tropical and game fish, sharks, stingrays, crocodiles, alligators, and birds. 12 million gallons of ocean water are pumped into the 3-acre natural saltwater lagoons daily. Having visited the facility on several occasions, one can take immense pleasure in lazily strolling along shaded paths around the pools, feeding the fish, and interacting with parrots at one of their many shows. The highlight for me to any visit to Theater of the Seas was just outside the gift shop, where dozens of rescued cats live on the property. That's right, a park that is dedicated to tropical sea and wildlife, and my favorite part is the rescued cats behind the gift shop. At last count, there were a dozen or so cats living quite the comfortable life outside in the gift shop yard, just a few short steps away from the park's $47.95 admission fee. Visiting the cats is free. Always visit the cats, even if nothing else. I crossed the Whale Harbor Channel Bridge and officially entered Isla Morada, the small town of the Keys. Often called a drinking village with a fishing problem, Isla Morada boasts of being the fisherman's paradise. Immediately after the bridge, on the left was Wahoo's Seafood Bar and Grill and Whale Harbor Seafood Buffet. It is at Wahoo's that the connoisseur of fine dining can get the best shrimp po' boy you've ever had in your life. Complimented with ocean views, boats, a super friendly waitstaff, and reasonable prices. The shrimp po' boy, served with fried shrimp on a hoagie roll, lettuce topped with fresh pico salsa, bang bang aioli, is $18. I don't know what bang bang aioli is, but I ate every bit of it on my last trip here. Passing through the most commercial area of Isla Morada, you get the sense of a small town dropped on a small coral island where flip-flops and shorts are the required attire. Though most businesses were closed and restaurants were serving up their last meals to the latecomers, the few bars along this stretch continued to serve their customers who were likely staying at one of the many resorts along this stretch. I slowly motored along, willing the tenths of a mile to come faster to my destination. Passing the History of Diving Museum, a place I have never been to in all the years of visiting the Keys, I made a pledge to myself that I would visit the facility on one of these trips. The Lorelei Restaurant and Cabana Bar were approaching on the right, and I was eager to dine there later this week. With tables set up on their beach and sunset dining the premium time to be there, one can expect a lengthy wait to get a table while a local band of some sort is usually playing on the deck to entertain diners lucky enough to get a seat there, and those waiting to be seated on the beach and have a cocktail while the sun set. Practically directly across the overseas highway from the Lorelei is the Islander Resort, boasting its 1950s-style entry sign that points to the sky at an angle, an island landmark, giving passerbys that George Jetson 1950s version of the future impression, as seen from many businesses and advertising from that era. Though I have never visited the resort, in my mind, I've imagined the whimsical and slightly campy setting of Disney World's Future World and its attractions as the backdrop for the lobby and rooms at the resort, which would have been cool, but the marketing geniuses of the resort completely dropped the ball, failing to capitalize on their already built-in theme, cool sign out front. The website for the resort gives the resort a more sophisticated appeal, offering visitors the opportunity to discover your inner islander while they feast on tropical-inspired culinary experiences, and when the sun goes down to relax as the glow of the moon ushers in hushed conversations around beachside bonfires and cozy private hammocks. I totally dig the whole Caribbean feel. Beachy, flip-flop, bathing suit, frozen drink, poolside in a bucket hat thing. But come on, a Jetsons theme on the beach in the Keys? Ruh-roh. The speed limit dropped to 35 miles per hour, and I shifted down into fourth to eliminate that low, slogging sound of the motor at the slow pace I was going as I passed by more tourist-attracting businesses. The Sandal Factory, T-shirt, and gift shop was highly active as I passed by, giving the throttle a little blip to push me past the business a little quicker, avoiding the plethora of cars lined up in the left turn lane to park in front of the building. With the road now down to two lanes, with a center turn lane and a bike lane that now shared the shoulder, activity this time of night was more than I expected, even though it was nearing closing time for many of the restaurants along this strip. The rumble of the bike's engine in fourth gear seemed a little too slow and downshifted into third to see if it would make much difference. Now it seemed too high, as if I were going too fast for that gear. I shifted back up into fourth and kept my speed right in the pocket of the speed limit and a little too fast. What little traffic there was, I told myself that if I at least kept up with the guy in front of me, I could at least claim I was keeping up with the flow of traffic. Noting, of course, that there was just one car in front of me and a car a few lengths behind me, which really doesn't necessarily qualify as traffic. I crossed the T-Table Relief Bridge over the T-Table Relief Channel onto Indian Key Fills, a group of three small coral islands that function as a causeway for the overseas highway. These three tiny islands were at one time a haven for day trippers coming down from the Miami area or other areas of the Keys to fish, swim, have cookouts, and small gatherings. Over the years, increasing abuse, litter, and traffic problems created by these daily visitors forced the village to close the area to parking and these activities. Crossing the fills this time of night, I could not see the azure and turquoise waters just a couple feet lower than the road surface. I couldn't see the shallows and gentle waves lapping against the loose coral along the edges of the small islands, barely 100 feet wide. But I could see orange traffic cones. It is Florida, after all. With the speed limit lowered to 35 miles per hour, I crossed over the Indian Channel Bridge onto the smallest of the fills, and then crossing the Lignum Vitae Channel Bridge, when off to my right, lit up in all its glory, was Robbie's of Isla Mirada, a waterfront tourist attraction that features a restaurant, bar, shops, open-air market, fishing, and a host of activities that include parasailing, scuba diving, kayaking, snorkeling, jet ski rentals, and for the less adventurous, tarpon feeding. Growing up to 8 feet in length and weighing up to 280 pounds, dozens of these large fish gather around the docks where visitors can toss fish to them. While visitors are not advised to stick their hands in the water, the tarpon will gladly come out of the water to take what you have in your hands. Much like the pelicans who wander the decks, who wait for the opportunity to snag a fish from your hand, and they're not shy about it by any means. Employees of Robbie's are regularly chasing the big birds away from the visitors, and a dry erase board at the entrance to the docks explicitly says, "Do not feed the pelicans." Despite the warnings from staff and signage, the pelicans make out well for themselves and don't appear to be starving. Robbie's also has the distinction of being one of the locations used for the filming of the psychological drama thriller cable TV show Bloodline. Here, brother Kevin Rayburn ran the marina in the back of Robbie's and did his best not to crack under pressure with the secret of his oldest brother's murder. Less than 2 miles away was the Topsider Resort. And although the speed limit ramped back up to 45 miles per hour, I kept it slightly under that to keep an eye out for the resort's entrance, which is largely unlit. Still a two-lane road with a wide shoulder on both sides. To my right, about 30 feet away, was an 8-foot-wide paved road used by residents as a means to access the overseas highway and for cyclists and runners. A few small lit signs announced small resorts that would dot the Gulf Coast along this section, and although I've been here several times, I've always struggled to find the driveway entrance to the Topsider. Adorned with only a lighted sign smaller than a sheet of plywood, the only other noticeable feature is a gray manatee mailbox that is the welcome sign to so many homes here in the Keys have. The smooth pavement and lack of a car behind me had me quite relaxed as I spotted the entrance and quickly slowed to make the turn. Putting on my signal and barely leaning into the turn onto the access drive, I instantly noticed the broken asphalt was littered with small beach stones and sand. I wasn't going fast enough to fall, but I was going fast enough for the debris to make the front wheel slide and the rear end of the bike could get squirrely. I recovered quickly, but it was enough of a wake-up call to slow to a walking pace. With my feet off the pegs and out either side as outriggers to keep my balance, I navigated the off-white beach stone driveway from the entrance to the base of our Topsider that would be my home for the next 9 days. I came to a stop just under the bedroom window and turned the large ignition switch on my center console to the off position. The rumble of the motor stopped, and with a light bird-like squeak that was all too familiar to me, and I was then surrounded by silence. I sat there for a long minute. It was 9:35 p.m., and I had just concluded 2 consecutive days of 600-plus miles of riding. I was tired and hungry. I wanted to get off the bike, bring my gear to the house, take a shower, eat a late dinner, and plop on the sofa in my pajamas. At the same time, I didn't. I felt like I wanted to keep going, keep riding, keep feeling the breeze on my face, keep hearing the low, comfortable rumble of the bike, keep moving. But to where? Nowhere in particular, just to keep going. I sighed. I reached back and unsnapped the front of my left saddlebag and reached my hand down inside the front of the bag until my hand met an orange kickstand puck. I pulled it out and dropped it on the pea gravel beneath where my kickstand should end up, and I was only a couple inches off when I deployed it. Leaning the bike over, I could hear the dull crunch of the stones under the weight of the bike as its weight shifted to the kickstand. I stood up and maneuvered myself out of the seat, hopping backwards on one foot until my other foot cleared the seat. As I was taking my gloves off, a voice from above welcomed me. "How was the ride?" my wife asked. I looked up and she was standing on the deck, leaning against the railing. "Not too bad. A lot of traffic. Glad to be here," I said now that I was standing and off the bike. "Dinner will be ready in a couple minutes. Do you need help bringing your stuff in?" she asked. "No, I'm going to bring in the tour pack and the smaller bag. I'll get the rest in the morning." She went back inside after saying okay. I started unstrapping the tour pack and other bags. I did all this with my helmet and jacket still on to eliminate the need to carry more stuff up two flights of stairs. I decided to do it in stages, one flight at a time, with two small loads. The 35-pound tour pack, being the heavyweight champion of the evening, turned the hike up the stairs into a laborious slog. The bike's motor pinged and dinged while I walked around it, putting away the straps and bungee cords and locking the bike. The stones crunched under my feet as I performed these menial tasks until I finally patted the big bike's tank. We were both done for the night. Miles ridden from Santee to Topsider in Isla Mirada, 670.63 miles. Moving time, 10 hours, 8 minutes. Elapsed time, 13 hours, 15 minutes. Average speed, 65 miles per hour. Maximum speed, 79 miles per hour. The Motorcycle Men Podcast is supporting David's Dream and Believe Cancer Foundation. If you would like to help and be a part of something that makes a difference, donate today to David's Dream and Believe Cancer Foundation. Go to davidsdreamandbelieve.org to donate. Links will also be in the show notes and, of course, on the Motorcycle Men website. And the Gold Star Ride Foundation, helping families of fallen soldiers and making a difference in the lives of those left behind. If you would like to be a part of a great cause and get some heartfelt miles in, get on over to goldstarride.org and learn how you can participate in the next Gold Star Ride. And we're helping long-haul Paul Phelan complete his mission to ride a million miles for MS. He was told years ago that a cure from MS was a million miles away, so he decided to ride that million miles for that cure. Now, you can help him out by getting on over to longhaulpaul.com and donate to his quest for that cure for MS. All right, thank you for joining me here in the V-Twin Cafe, where you just heard Chapter 18 of The Road Most Traveled. The audiobook is available on audible.com. There are direct links on the Motorcycle Men website where you can get them. And it depends upon where you are. If you are in the UK, in Germany, France, Australia, and Canada, there are individual links to each one of those purchases for the audiobook, for the print book as well. So make sure you get on over there. Don't forget to get on over to the Ride with Ted YouTube channel to watch some of the many videos I have there. And if you would please also like and subscribe, that would be a tremendous help to the channel and, of course, to the podcast. So that's it, boys and girls, for the rest of the Motorcycle Men team. Thanks for listening. And remember, kids, we say stupid crap so you don't have to. Ride safely, kids.